hug.
And now they were beginning to look at one another, each wondering if his neighbor was thinking the same thing. This kid is out to lunch. The voice rose, rose, then peaked with a note just this side of a yodel before plunging to a lower range with a teary cascade of vibrato and coming to an abrupt halt. The service was over. The audience paused, but Fallow did not. He slipped out into the aisle and, crouching slightly, began hurrying down toward the front. He was 10 or 12 rows from the front when a figure ahead of him did the same thing. It was a man wearing a navy blue suit, a snap-brim hat, and dark glasses. Fallow caught only the briefest glimpse of the side of his head, the chin. It was Sherman McCoy. He had no doubt worn the hat and the glasses in order to enter the funeral home without being recognized. He rounded the bend at the first pew and fell in behind the family's little entourage. Fallow did the same. Now he could get a glimpse of the profile. It was McCoy, all right. The crowd was already in the hubbub of departing a funeral service and letting off the steam of 30 or 40 minutes of obligatory respectfulness toward a rich man who, while alive, had not been particularly warm or likable. A funeral parlor functionary was holding open the little side door for the widow Ruskin. McCoy stayed close on the heels of a tall man who was, in fact, as Fallow could now see, Monty Griswold, the master of ceremonies. The eulogizers were joining the family backstage. McCoy and Fallow were merely part of a mournful troop of dark blue suits and black dresses. Fallow folded his arms over his chest to hide the brass buttons on his blazer for fear they would look out of place. There was no problem. The funeral home doorman was intent only on herding inside everyone who was going inside. The little door led to a short flight of stairs, at the top of which was a suite of rooms, like a little apartment. Everyone gathered in a small reception room decorated with balloon shades and panels of fabric framed in gilded wood in the 19th-century French manner. Everyone was paying his condolences to the widow, who could scarcely be seen behind the wall of blue suits. McCoy hung about the edges, still wearing his dark glasses. Fallow stayed behind McCoy. He could hear the baritone burble of Hubert Burnley talking to the widow and no doubt saying perfectly proper and fatuous things with a sad but charming Burnley smile on his face. Now it was Senator Greenspan's turn, and his nasal voice could be heard saying no doubt several wrong things along with the right ones. And then Monty Griswold had his turn, uttering impeccable things, one could be sure, and waiting to receive the widow's compliments for his skills as MC. Monty Griswold said goodbye to the widow Ruskin and, bango, McCoy confronted her. Fallow was right behind him. He could see Maria Ruskin's features through the black veil. Young and beautiful, nothing quite like it. Her dress accentuated her breasts and brought out the conformation of her lower abdomen. She was looking straight at McCoy. McCoy leaned so close to her face, Fallow thought at first he was going to kiss her, but he was whispering. The widow Ruskin was saying something in a low voice. Fallow leaned in closer. He crouched right behind McCoy. He couldn't make it out, a word here and there. Straight, essential, both, car. Car. As soon as he heard the word, Fallow experienced a feeling that journalists live for. Before the mind can digest what the ears have just heard, an alarm puts the nervous system on red alert, a story. It is a neural event, a feeling as palpable as any recorded by the five senses. A story. Damn, McCoy was mumbling again. Fallow leaned in still closer. Other one, ramp, skidded. Ramp, skidded. The widow's voice rose.
Shaman? She seemed to be calling him Shaman. Can't we talk about it later?
Letter? Wondered Fallow. Something about a letter?
Then he realized she was saying later. Now McCoy's voice rose.
Time, Maria. Right there with me. You're my only witness.
I can't make myself think about all that now, Shaman.
The same strained voice, ending with a little throb in the throat.
Can't you understand? Don't you know where you are? My husband's dead, Shaman.
She cast her eyes down and began shaking with soft sobs. Immediately, a wide, squat man was by her side. It was Raymond Radoge, who had spoken during the service. More sobs. McCoy walked away quickly, heading out of the room. For an instant, Fallow started to follow him, then wheeled about. The widow Ruskin was the story now. Radoge was now hugging the widow so hard the enormous shoulders of her mourning outfit were buckling. She looked lopsided.
"It's okay, honey," he said. "You're a brave kid, and I know exactly how you feel because me and Artie went through a lot together. We go back a long, long way. Back before you weren't even born, I guess. And I can tell you one thing. Artie would have liked the service. I can tell you that. He would have liked it, with the senator and everybody." He waited for a compliment.
The widow Ruskin pulled her grief together. It was the only way to disengage from her ardent mourner.
"But you, most especially, Ray," she said. "You knew him best, and you knew just how to put it. I know Arthur rests easier for what you said."
"Ah, well, thank you, Maria. You know, I could kind of see Artie in front of me while I was talking. I didn't have to think what I was gonna say. It just came out."
Presently he departed, and Fallow stepped forward. The widow smiled at him, just the least bit disconcerted because she didn't know who he was.
"I'm Peter Fallow," he said. "As you may know, I was with your husband when he died."
"Oh, yes,"
she said, giving him a quizzical look.
"I just wanted you to know," said Fallow, "that he didn't suffer. He simply lost consciousness. It happened," Fallow brought his hands up in a gesture of helplessness, "like that. I wanted you to know that everything that could have been done was done, or so it seems to me. I attempted artificial respiration, and the police responded very rapidly. I know how one can wonder about these things, and I wanted you to know. We had just had an excellent dinner and an excellent conversation. The last thing I remember was your husband's wonderful laugh. In all honesty, I must tell you there are worse ways. It's a terrible loss, but it was not a terrible ending."
"Thank you," she said. "You're awfully kind to tell me this. I've reproached myself for being away from him when—"
"You shouldn't," said Fallow.
The widow Ruskin looked up at him and smiled. He was aware of the sparkle in her eyes and the curious curl of her lips. She was able to put a coquettish edge even on a widow's thanks. Without changing his tone of voice, Fallow said,
"I couldn't help but notice Mr. McCoy speaking to you."
The widow was smiling with her lips parted slightly. First the smile shrank away. Then the lips closed.
"In fact, I couldn't help but overhear your conversation," said Fallow.
Then, with a bright and amiable look on his face and a full-blown English country weekend accent, as if he were asking about the guest list at a dinner party,
"I gather you were in the car with Mr. McCoy when he had his unfortunate accident in the Bronx."
The widow's eyes turned into a pair of cinders.
"I was hoping that perhaps you might tell me exactly what happened that night."
Maria Ruskin stared at him a moment longer and then said between tight lips,
"Look, Mr.
Fallow."
"Peck ahead. This is my husband's funeral, and I don't want you here, you understand? So get out and disintegrate."
She turned and walked off toward Radoge in a group of blue suits and black dresses. As he left the Harold A. Burns funeral home, Fallow was giddy with the knowledge of what he had. The story existed not only in his mind, but in his skin and his solar plexus. It surged like a current in every axon and dendrite of his body. As soon as he got near the word processor, the story would pour out of his fingers, preformed. He wouldn't have to say, allege, imply, speculate that the beautiful and now fabulously wealthy merry young widow Ruskin was the mystery brunette. McCoy had said it for him.
right there with me, my only witness. The Widow Ruskin had remained tight-lipped, but she hadn't denied it, nor had she denied it when the journalist, the great fellow, when I, that was it. He would write it in the first person, another first-person exclusive, like Death New York style. I, Fallow, dear God, he hungered, lusted for the word processor. The story vibrated in his mind, his heart, his very groin. But he made himself stop by the register in the vestibule and copy down the names of all the celebrated souls who had been on hand to pay their respects to the lovely widow of Mecca's kosher ferry captain, without dreaming of the drama unfolding beneath their prurient noses. They would know soon enough. I, Fallow. Out on the sidewalk, just beyond the vestibule, were clusters of these very same luminous personages, most of them having the sort of exuberant, grinning conversations people in New York somehow can't help having at events that dramatize their exalted status. Funerals were no exception. The huge young cantor, Myron Bronoskowitz, was talking with, or talking to, a severe-looking older man whose name Fallow had just copied from the register. Jonathan Buckman, the chief executive officer of Columbia Records. The cantor spoke with great animation. His hands made little flights in the air. Buckman's expression was rigid, paralyzed by the sonorous logorrhea that spewed so ceaselessly into his face.
"No problem," said the cantor.
It was almost a shout.
"No problem at all. I've already made the cassettes. I've done every one of the Caruso standards. I can have them over to your office tomorrow. You got a card?"
The last thing Fallow saw before he left was Buckman fishing a card out of a trim little lizard-skin card wallet, while Cantor Bronoskowitz added in the same declamatory tenor,
"Mario Lanza, too. I've done Mario Lanza. I want you to have them, too."
"Well..."
"No problem."
Chapter 29 The Rendezvous. The next morning, Kramer and Bernie Fitzgibbon and the two detectives, Martin and Goldberg, were in Abe Weiss's office. It was like a board meeting. Weiss sat at the head of the big walnut conference table. Fitzgibbon and Goldberg sat to his left, Kramer and Martin to his right. The subject was how to proceed with a grand jury hearing on the Sherman McCoy case. Weiss did not like what he was now hearing from Martin. Neither did Kramer. From time to time, Kramer took a look at Bernie Fitzgibbon. All he could make out was a mask of black Irish impassivity, but it emitted short waves that said, "I told you so." "Wait a minute," said Weiss. He was talking to Martin. "Tell me again how you picked up these two characters."
"It was in a crack sweep," said Martin.
"A crack sweep?" said Weiss. "What the hell's a crack sweep?"
"A crack sweep's, that's what we do now. Some blocks up there, there's so many crack dealers in the block, it's like a flea market. A lot of the buildings are abandoned, and the others, the people that live there, they're afraid to come out the front door because there's nothing on the street but people selling crack, people buying crack, and people smoking crack. So we make these sweeps. We move in and we pick up everything that's loose."
"Does it work?"
"Sure. You do it a couple of times and they'll move to another block. It's got to the point where as soon as the first cruiser comes around the corner, they start running from the buildings. It's like these construction sites when they set off the dynamite and the rats start running down the street. Somebody ought to take along a movie camera one time. Here's all these people running down the fucking street."
"Okay," said Weiss. "So these two guys you picked up, they know Roland Auburn?"
"Yeah, they all know Roland."
"Okay. So what you're telling us, this is something Roland told them personally, or is this something they heard?"
"No, this is the word that's going around."
"In Bronx crack circles," said Weiss.
"Yeah, I guess," said Martin.
"Okay, go ahead."
"Well, the word is that Roland happens to see this kid, Henry Lamb, walking up to the Texas Fried Chicken place, and he tags along. Roland enjoys giving this kid a hard time. Lamb's what they call a good-doing boy, a mama's boy, a boy who don't come out. He don't come out of the house and get into the street life. He goes to school. He goes to church. He wants to go to college. He don't get into trouble. He don't even belong in the projects. His mother's trying to save up money for a down payment on a house in Springfield Gardens, or they wouldn't even be living there.
These two guys didn't tell you that.
No, that's what we already found out about the kid and his mother.
Well, let's stick to these two smokeheads and what they said.
I was trying to give you the background.
Good. Now give me the foreground.
All right. So anyway, Roland's walking down Bruckner Boulevard with Lamb. They're walking past the ramp at Hunts Point Avenue, and Roland sees this shit on the ramp. These tires or trash cans or something, and he knows somebody's been up there trying to take off cars. So he says to Lamb, "Come on, I'll show you how to take off a car." Lamb don't want any part of that, and so Roland says, "I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to show you how you do it." "What are you afraid of?" He's, you know, taunting the kid because he's such a mama's boy. So the kid walks up on the ramp with him, and the next thing he knows, Roland throws a tire or a can or something in front of this car, this terrific-looking Mercedes, and it turns out to be McCoy and some broad. This poor fucker, Lamb, is just standing there. He's probably scared shitless to be there, and he's scared shitless about running, too, because of Roland, who's only doing this whole number to let him know what a faggot he is in the first place. Then something goes wrong, because McCoy and the woman manage to get the hell out of there, and Lamb gets sideswiped. Anyway, that's what's going around out on the street.
Well, that's some theory, but have you found anybody who says they actually heard Roland say any of that?
Bernie Fitzgibbon broke in.
That theory would explain why Lamb don't say anything about being hit by a car when he goes to the hospital. He don't want anybody to think he was involved in trying to take off a car. He just wants to get his wrist fixed up and go home.
Yeah, said Weiss, but all we got here is a theory presented by two smokeheads. These people don't know the difference between what they're hearing and what they're hearing.
He twirled his forefinger up around his temple in the Looney Tunes mode.
"Well, I think it's worth checking out, Abe," said Bernie. "I think we ought to spend a little time on it anyhow."
Kramer felt alarmed and resentful and protective, protective of Roland Auburn. None of them had bothered to get to know Roland the way he had. Roland was not a saint, but he had goodness in him, and he was telling the truth. He said to Bernie, "There's no harm in checking it out, but I can think of ways a theory like this actually gets started. I mean, it's really the McCoy theory. It's what McCoy fed the Daily News, and it's on TV. I mean, this theory is already out on the street, and this is what it grows into. It answers one question, but it raises 10 more. I mean, why would Roland try to take off a car with this kid along who he knows is a wimp, a lame? And if McCoy is the victim of a robbery attempt and he hits one of his assailants, why would he hesitate to report it to the cops? He'd do it like that!" Kramer snapped his fingers and realized an argumentative tone had taken over his voice.
"I agree. It raises a lot of questions," said Bernie. "All the more reason not to rush this thing through the grand jury."
"We got to rush it," said Weiss.
Kramer caught Bernie looking at him in a certain way. He could see accusations in his black Irish eyes. Just then the telephone on Weiss's desk gave three low beeps. He got up, walked over to the desk, and answered it.
"Yeah? Okay, put him on."
"No, I haven't seen the city light."
"What? You gotta be kidding."
He turned toward the conference table and said to Bernie,
"It's Milt. I don't think we gotta worry about any smokehead theories for a while."
In no time, Milt Lovell, wide-eyed, slightly out of breath, was walking into the room with a copy of the City Light. He laid it on the conference table. The front page jumped up at them. City Light exclusive. Financier's widow is McCoy case mystery girl. McCoy at funeral. Help me. Across the bottom of the page ran a line saying, "Peter Fallow's eyewitness report, pictures, pages 3, 4, 5, 14, 15. All six of them stood up and leaned over with their palms on the walnut table to support themselves, their heads converging over the epicenter, which was the headline. Weiss straightened up. On his face was the look of the man who knows that it falls to his lot to be the leader.
"All right. Here's what we're going to do. Milt, call up Irv Stone at Channel 1.
He then reeled off the names of the news producers of five other channels.
and call Fallow and that fella Flanagan at the news, and here's what you tell them. We're going to question this woman as soon as possible. That's for the record. Not for attribution. Tell him if she is the woman who was with McCoy, then she faces felony charges, because she was the one who drove off after McCoy hit the kid. That's leaving the scene and failure to report. Hit and run. He hit, she ran. Okay? Then to Bernie. And you guys... He let his eyes pan quickly over Kramer, Martin, and Goldberg to show them they were included. You guys get hold of this woman and you tell her the exact same thing. We're sorry your husband is dead, etc., 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 but we need some answers very fast, and if you're the one who was in the car with McCoy, then you're in a whole lot of freaking trouble. But if she's willing to come clean about McCoy, we'll grant her immunity before the grand jury. To Kramer. Don't get too specific about that at first. Well, hell, you know how to do it. By the time Kramer, Martin, and Goldberg pulled up in front of 962 Fifth Avenue, the sidewalk looked like a refugee camp. Television crewmen, radio broadcasters, reporters, and photographers sat, milled, and lollygagged about in the jeans, knit shirts, zipper jackets, and Trapper Dan shoes their trade currently affected, and the idle gawkers who looked on weren't dressed much better. The cops from the 19th Precinct had set up a double row of blue police line sawhorses to create an alley to the front door for the benefit of the people who lived in the building. A uniformed patrolman stood by. For such a building, 14 stories high and half a block wide, the front entrance was not particularly grand. Nevertheless, it bespoke money. There was a single plate glass door framed in heavy brass, highly polished, and protected by an ornate brass grillwork, which also gleamed. A canopy stretched from the door to the edge of the sidewalk. The canopy was supported by brass poles with brass guy rods, likewise polished until they looked like white gold. As much as anything else, it was the eternity of mule's work represented by all the hand-polished brass that said money. Behind the plate glass, Kramer could see the figures of a pair of uniformed doormen, and he thought of Martin and his soliloquy on the shitballs at McCoy's building. Well, here he was. He had looked up at these apartment buildings on Fifth Avenue, facing Central Park, 1,000 times at least, most recently on Sunday afternoon. He had been out in the park with Rhoda, who was pushing Joshua in the baby carriage. And the afternoon sun had lit up the great limestone facades to the point where the phrase itself had crossed his mind, the Gold Coast. But it was merely an observation, devoid of emotion, except perhaps for a mild feeling of satisfaction at being able to stroll amid such golden surroundings. It was well known that the richest people in New York lived in those buildings. But their life, whatever it was as remote as another planet. Such people were merely types, far outside the range of any conceivable envy. They were the rich. He couldn't have told you the name of a single one of them. Now he could. Kramer, Martin, and Goldberg got out of the car, and Martin said something to the cop in the uniform. The raggedy pack of journalists bestirred themselves. Their itchy clothes flopped about. They looked the three of them up and down and sniffed for the scent of the McCoy case. Would they recognize him? The car was unmarked, and even Martin and Goldberg were wearing coats and ties, and so they might pass for three men who just happened to be coming to this building. On the other hand, was he any longer just an anonymous functionary of the criminal justice system? Hardly. His picture, by luscious Lucy Della Floria, had appeared on television. His name had appeared in every newspaper. They started walking up the alley between the police barricades. Halfway there, Kramer felt let down. Not a tumble from this huge, twitching assembly of the New York press. Then, "Hey, Kramer!" A voice over to his right. His heart leapt. "Kramer!" His impulse was to turn and smile, but he fought it. Should he just keep on walking and ignore it? No, he shouldn't high-hat them, should he? So he turned toward the voice with a look of high seriousness on his face. Two voices at once. "Hey, Kramer, you gonna... What are the charges? Talk to her? Against her?" He heard someone else saying, "Who is that?"
and someone answering, "That's Larry Kramer. He's the DA on this case."
Kramer kept his lips set grimly and said, "I got nothing for you right now, fellas."
Fellas. They were his now, this bunch. The press, which was formerly merely an abstraction, so far as he was concerned. Now he was looking the whole itchy mob of them in the face, and they hung on his every word, his every step. One, two, three photographers were in position. He could hear the whine of the rewind mechanisms of their cameras. A television crew was lumbering over. A video camera protruded from the skull of one of them like a horn. Kramer walked a bit slower and stared at one of the reporters as if considering a reply to give the fellows a few more seconds of this solemn mug of his. They were only doing their job. When he and Martin and Goldberg reached the front door, Kramer said to the two doormen, with guttural authority, "Larry Kramer, Bronx District Attorney's Office. They're expecting us." The doorman hopped to it. Upstairs, the door to the apartment was opened by a little man in uniform who appeared to be Indonesian or Korean. Kramer stepped inside, and the sight dazzled him. This was to be expected, since it was designed to dazzle people far more inured to luxury than Larry Kramer. He glanced at Martin and Goldberg. The three of them were straight-out sightseers. The two-story ceiling, the enormous chandelier, the marble staircase, the fluted pilasters, the silver, the balcony, the huge paintings, the sumptuous frames, any one of which, just the frame, cost about half a cop's annual pay. Their eyes were gobbling it all up. Kramer could hear a vacuum cleaner going somewhere upstairs. A maid in a black uniform with a white apron appeared on the marble floor of the entry gallery and then disappeared. The Oriental butler led them across the gallery. Through a doorway, they got an eyeful of a vast room flooded with light from the tallest windows Kramer's had ever seen in a private home. They were as big as the windows in the courtrooms of the island fortress. They looked out over the tops of the trees of Central Park. The butler took them to a smaller, darker room next to it, or it was darker by comparison. In fact, a single tall window facing the park admitted so much light that at first the two men and the woman who waited inside were visible only as silhouettes. The two men were standing. The woman sat in a chair. There was a set of rolling library stairs, a large desk with gilded decorations on its curved legs, and antique knick-knacks on top of it, plus two small couches with a large burled wood coffee table between them, several armchairs and side tables, and this stuff. One of the silhouettes stepped forward from out of the glare and said,
"Mr. Kramer, I'm Tucker Trigg."
Tucker Trigg. That was the guy's actual name. He was her lawyer from Curry, Goad, and Pesterall. Kramer had set up this meeting through him. Tucker Trigg had a nasal honk wasp voice that really put Kramer off, but now that Kramer could see him, he didn't look like his idea of a wasp. He was big, round, pudgy, like a football player gone to fat. They shook hands, and Tucker Trigg said in his honk voice,
"Mr. Kramer, this is Mrs. Ruskin."
She was seated in a high-backed armchair that made Kramer think of one of those series on Masterpiece Theater. There was a tall, gray-haired guy standing beside her. The widow. How young and bouncy she looked. Foxy, Roland had said. Arthur Ruskin had had a lot on his hands, 71 years old, with his second pacemaker ticking away. She wore a plain black silk dress. The fact that the wide shoulders and cadet collar treatment were currently quite chic was lost on Larry Kramer, but her legs weren't. Her legs were crossed. Kramer tried to keep his eyes from running up the high-lit curve of the top of her foot and the glistening curve of her calves and the shimmering curve of her thighs under the black silk. He tried his best. She had the most wonderful, long, ivory neck, and her lips were parted slightly, and her dark eyes seemed to be drinking his right up. He was flustered.
"I'm sorry to intrude under these circumstances," he stammered.
He immediately felt he had said something foolish. Was she supposed to conclude that under other circumstances he would be happy to intrude?
"Oh, I understand, Mr. Crammer,"
she said softly with a brave smile. Or was it merely a brave smile? God almighty, the way she looked at him. He couldn't imagine what to say to her next. Tucker Trigg spared him the task by introducing the man who stood next to the chair. He was a tall, older man. His gray hair was combed back smartly. He had the sort of military posture seldom seen in New York. His name was Clifford Pretty, and he was well known for defending prominent people in federal criminal cases. This one had WASP written all over him. He looked at you straight down his long, thin nose. His clothes were subdued and rich, as only these bastards knew how to do it. His shiny black shoes were oh so sweetly fitted in the instep and trim in the toe. The man made Crammer feel clumsy. His own shoes were heavy brown sloggers, with soles that stuck out like rock ledges. Well, this case wasn't in federal court, where the old Ivy League network still looked out for its own. No, they were dealing with the basic Bronx now.
"How do you do, Mr. Crammer?" said Mr. Clifford Pretty, affably.
"Fine," said Crammer, shaking hands and thinking, "let's see how smug you look when we get you up to Gibraltar." Then he introduced Martin and Goldberg, and everyone sat down. Martin and Goldberg and Tucker Trigg and Clifford Pretty. There was a quartet for you. Goldberg sat hunched over, a bit subdued, but Martin was still the tourist unfazed. His eyes were dancing all over the room. The young widow in black pressed a button on the table beside her chair. She recrossed her legs. The curved sheens flew apart and reassembled, and Crammer tried to avert his eyes. She looked toward the doorway. A maid, a Filipino, if Crammer had to guess, was standing there. Maria Ruskin looked at Crammer and then Goldberg and Martin and said,
"Would you gentlemen care for some coffee?"
No one cared for coffee. She said,
"Nora, I'd like some coffee and
Cora,"
the woman said tonelessly. Every head turned toward her, as if she had just produced a revolver.
"And bring some extra cups, please,"
said the widow, ignoring the correction,
"in case any of the gentlemen change their mind."
Not perfect with the grammar, thought Crammer. He tried to figure out exactly what was wrong with what she had said, and then realized that everyone was quiet and looking at him. Now it was his show. The widow's lips were parted in the same strange little smile. Was it bravery? Mockery? "Mrs. Ruskin," he began, "as I say, I'm sorry to have to come to you at this particular time, and I'm very grateful for your cooperation. I'm sure Mr. Trigg and Mr. Pretty have explained to you the purpose of this meeting, and I just, want to..." She stirred her legs under her dress, and Crammer tried not to notice the way her thighs welled up under the shiny black silk. "Emphasize that this case, which involves a very serious injury, possibly fatal, to a young man, Henry Lamb, this case is highly important to our office because it's highly important to the people of Bronx County and to all the people of this city." He paused. He realized he was sounding pompous, but he didn't know how to get back down off his high horse. The presence of these WASP lawyers and the scale of this palace had made him get up here.
"I understand,"
said the widow, possibly to help him out. Her head was slightly cocked, and she smiled the smile of an intimate friend. Crammer had rogue stirrings. His mind leapt ahead to the trial. Sometimes he ended up working very closely with a cooperative witness. "That's why your cooperation would be of such great value to us." He threw his head back to emphasize the grandeur of his sternocleidomastoid muscles. "Now all I want to do right now is to try to explain to you what's going to be involved if you do cooperate, or if for any reason you decide not to cooperate, because I think we have to be completely clear on that. Certain things are going to naturally flow from either decision. Now, before we start, I should remind you that..." He paused again. He had started the sentence off wrong and was going to get tangled up in his syntax. Nothing to do but plow on.
You're represented by eminent counsel, so I don't have to remind you of your rights in that respect.
In that respect? Why these pompous, pointless block phrases?
But I am obliged to remind you of your right to remain silent, should you want to, for any reason.
He looked at her and nodded, as if to say, "Is that clear?" She nodded back, and he noticed the swell of her breasts moving under the black silk. From beside the chair, he lifted his attaché case up to his lap and immediately wished he didn't have to. The case's scuffed corners and edges were an exposé of his lowly status. A $36,000-a-year assistant DA from the Bronx. Look at the goddamn case, all dried out, cracked, and scuffed. He felt humiliated. What was going through these fucking wasps' minds at this moment? Were they just holding back their smirks for tactical reasons or out of some condescending wasp politeness? From the case, he took two pages of notes on yellow legal paper and a folder full of Xeroxed material, including some newspaper clippings. Then he closed up the telltale luggage and put it back on the floor. He looked down at his notes. He looked up at Maria Ruskin. "There are four persons known to have intimate knowledge of this case," he said. "One is the victim, Henry Lamb, who is in an apparently irreversible coma. One is Mr. Sherman McCoy, who is charged with reckless endangerment, leaving the scene of an accident, and failure to report an accident. He denies these charges. One is an individual who was present when the incident occurred and who has come forth and has positively identified Mr. McCoy as the driver of the car that struck Mr. Lamb. This witness has told us that Mr. McCoy was accompanied in that car by another person, a white female in her 20s, and the information provided makes her his accomplice in one or more of the felonies that Mr. McCoy is charged with." He paused, for what he hoped would be maximum effect. "That witness has positively identified that woman as yourself." Kramer now stopped and looked the widow squarely in the face. At first, she was perfection. She didn't blink. Her lovely, brave little smile never wavered. But then her Adam's apple almost imperceptibly went up and down just once. She swallowed. An excellent feeling came over Kramer, in every cell and every neural fiber. In that instant, the instant of that little swallow, his scuffed attaché case meant nothing. Nor did his clodhopper shoes, nor his cheap suit, nor his measly salary, nor his New York accent, nor his barbarisms and solecisms of speech. For in that moment, he had something that these wasp counselors, these immaculate Wall Street partners from the universe of the Curries and Goads and Pesterols and Dunnings and Spongets and Leeches, would never know and never feel the inexpressible pleasure of possessing. And they would remain silent and polite in the face of it, as they were right now, and they would swallow with fear when and if their time came. And he now understood what it was that gave him a momentary lift each morning as he saw the island fortress rise at the crest of the Grand Concourse from the gloom of the Bronx. For it was nothing less than the power. The same power to which Abe Wise himself was totally given over. It was the power of the government over the freedom of its subjects. To think of it in the abstract made it seem so theoretical and academic, but to feel it, to see the looks on their faces as they stare back at you, courier and conduit of the power. Arthur Rivera, Jimmy Dollard, Herbert 92X, and the guy called Pimp, even them. And now to see that little swallow of fright in a perfect neck worth millions. Well, the poet has never sung of that ecstasy or even dreamed of it, and no prosecutor, no judge, no cop, no income tax auditor will ever enlighten him. For we dare not even mention it to one another, do we? And yet we feel it. And we know it every time they look at us with those eyes that beg for mercy, or if not mercy, Lord, dumb luck, or capricious generosity, just one break.
What are all the limestone facades of Fifth Avenue and all the marble halls and stuffed leather libraries and all the riches of Wall Street in the face of my control of your destiny and your helplessness in the face of the power? Kramer stretched that moment out for as long as the bounds of logic and minimal decency would allow, and then just a little bit longer. None of them, not the two immaculate WASP lawyers from Wall Street and not the beautiful young widow with her new millions, dared make a peep. Then he said softly, paternally, "All right. Now let's see what that means." When Sherman entered Killian's office, Killian said,
"Hey, what are you, what's the long face for? You won't mind coming all the way down here when I tell you why. Did you think I brought you down here to show you this?"
He tossed the city light over to the edge of the desk. Financier's widow, Sherman barely glanced at it. It had already come humming and sizzling into the arcade.
"He was right there in the room at Burns's, this Peter Fallow. I never saw him."
"It don't matter," said Killian, who was in a jolly mood. "This is old news. We already knew this, am I right? I brought you down here for the news."
The truth was, Sherman didn't mind these trips down to Reed Street at all. Sitting in the apartment, waiting for the next telephone threat, the very grandeur of the apartment mocked what he had now been reduced to. He sat there and waited for the next blow. Doing anything was preferable. Riding in a car to Reed Street, moving horizontally without resistance. Swell. Terrific. Sherman sat down, and Killian said, "I didn't want to even mention this over the telephone, but I got a very interesting telephone call. The jackpot, in fact." Sherman just looked at him.
"Maria Ruskin," said Killian.
"You're kidding."
"That I wouldn't kid you about."
"Maria called you?"
"Mr. Killian, my name is Maria Ruskin. I'm a friend of a client of yours, Mr. Sherman McCoy."
"Does that sound like the correct party?"
"My God, what did she say? What did she want?"
"She wants to see you."
"I'll be damned. She wants to see you this afternoon at 4:30. She said you'd know where."
"I'll be damned. You know, she told me yesterday at Burns's she was going to call me, but I didn't believe that for a second."
"Did she say why?"
"No, and I didn't ask her. I didn't want to say one word that might make her change her mind. All I said was, I was sure you'd be there. And I'm sure you will be, bro."
"Didn't I tell you she'd call me?"
"You did? You just said you didn't believe she would."
"I know. Yesterday I didn't because she's been avoiding me, but didn't I say she wasn't the cautious type?"
"She's a gambler. She's not the type to play it safe. She likes to mix it up, and her game is, well, it's men. Your game is the law, mine is investments, hers is men."
Killian started chuckling, more at the change in Sherman's spirits than anything else.
"Okay," he said. "Terrific. Let's you and her play. Let's get started. I had another reason for bringing you down here instead of me coming up to your place. We gotta get you wired."
He pressed a button and said into the intercom,
"Nina, tell Ed Quigley to come in here."
At precisely 4:30, with his heart pumping away at a good clip, Sherman pressed the bell marked 4B, Bowl. She must have been waiting by the intercom box. The intercom itself no longer worked, because right away he could hear a buzz in the door and the heavy click-click-click of the electric lock opening, and he entered the townhouse. The smell was instantly familiar, the dead air, the filthy carpet on the stairs. There was the same old lugubrious paint and battered doorways and the dismal light, familiar and at the same time new and dreadful, as if he had never taken the trouble to notice what was really here. The wonderful bohemian spell of the place was broken. He now had the misfortune to gaze at an erotic dream with the eyes of a realist. How could he ever have found it enchanting? The creak of the stairs reminded him of things he wanted to forget. He could still see the dachshund hauling his fat tube up the risers.
"You're a wet little piece of salami, Marshall."
and he had been sweating. Sweating, he had made 3 trips up this decrepit staircase, carrying Maria's luggage. And now he carried the heaviest burden of all. I'm wired. He could feel the tape deck in the small of his back, the microphone over his sternum. He could feel, or he imagined he felt, the grip of the tape that held the wire to his body. Each of these artful, stealthy, miniaturized elements seemed to grow with each step he took. His skin magnified them, like a tongue feeling a broken tooth. Surely they were obvious. How much of it showed on his face? How much deceit? How much dishonor? He sighed and discovered he was already sweating and panting from the climb or from adrenaline or from funk. The heat of his body made the tape prickly. Or was it his imagination? By the time he reached the door, that sad painted door, he was breathing hard. He paused, sighed again, then rapped on the door with the signal they had always used. Tap, tap, a tap, 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 tap. The door opened slowly. But there was no one there. Then,
boo!
Her head popped out from behind the door, and she was grinning at him.
Scare you?
Not really, said Sherman. Lately, I've been scared by experts. She laughed, and it seemed to be a genuine laugh.
You too? We're a pair, aren't we, Sherman?
With that, she held out her arms to him, the way you would for a welcoming embrace. Sherman stared at her, astonished, confused, paralyzed. The calculations running through his mind faster than he could deal with them. There she was, in a black silk dress, her widow's weeds, fitted closely at the waist so that her gorgeous body welled out above and below. Her eyes were large and brilliant. Her dark hair was perfection itself with a luxurious sheen. Her coyly curved lips, which had always driven him crazy, were full and parted and smiling. But it added up to nothing but a certain arrangement of clothes and flesh and hair. There was a slight frieze of dark hair on her forearms. He should slip between those arms and embrace her, if that's what she wanted. It was a delicate moment. He needed her on his side, in his confidence, for however long it took to get certain matters of fact into the microphone over his sternum and onto the tape in the small of his back. A delicate moment, and a dreadful dilemma. Suppose he embraced her, and she felt the microphone, or ran her hands down his back. He had never considered such a thing, not for a moment. Who would even want to embrace a man who was wired? Nevertheless, do something. So he moved toward her, thrusting his shoulders forward and humping his back so that she couldn't possibly flatten herself against his chest. Thus they embraced, a voluptuous, supple young thing and a mysterious cripple. Quickly, he disengaged, trying to smile, and she looked at him as if to see if he was all right.
You're right, Maria. We are a pair. We're on the front page.
He smiled philosophically. So let's get down to cases. Nervously, he looked about the room.
Come on,
she said.
Sit down.
She gestured toward the oak pedestal table.
I'll get you a drink. What would you like?
Fine. Let's sit down and talk.
Any scotch?
She went into the kitchen, and he looked down at his chest to make sure the microphone didn't show. He tried to run over the questions in his mind. He wondered if the tape was still running. Presently, she returned with his drink and one for herself, a clear drink, gin or vodka. She sat down in the other bentwood chair and crossed her legs, her glistening legs, and smiled. She raised her glass as if in a toast. He did the same.
So here we are, Sherman, the couple all New York is talking about. There's a lot of people like to hear this conversation.
Sherman's heart jumped. He was dying to peek downward to see if his microphone was showing. Was she insinuating something? He studied her face. He couldn't make out a thing.
Yes, here we are, he said. To tell you the truth, I thought you'd decided to vanish on me. I haven't had a very pleasant time since you left.
Sherman, I swear to you I didn't know anything about it until I got back.
But you didn't even tell me you were going.
I know, but that had nothing to do with you, Sherman. I was half crazy.
What did it have to do with? He tilted his head and smiled to show he wasn't bitter.
With Arthur?
Ah, with Arthur.
Yes, with Arthur. You think I had a very free and easy arrangement with Arthur, and in a way I did, but I also had to live with him, and nothing was really free with Arthur. He took it out one way or the other. I told you how he'd started swearing at me.
You mentioned it.
Calling me a whore and a bitch right out in front of the servants or anybody else if he felt like it. Such resentment, Sherman. Arthur wanted a young wife, and then he turned around and hated me because I was young and he was an old man. He wanted exciting people around because he thought with all his money he deserved exciting people, and then he turned around and he hated them and he hated me because they were my friends or else they were more interested in me than they were in him. The only people interested in Arthur were those old yids like Ray Radoge. I hope you saw what a fool he made of himself at the funeral. Then he came in the back there and started trying to hug me. I thought he was going to pull my dress off me. Did you see that? You were so excited. I kept trying to tell you to calm down. I never saw you like that. And that big-nosed bastard from the City Light, that horrible, hypocritical Brit, was standing right behind you. He heard you.
I know I was excited, he said. I thought you were ducking me. I was afraid it was the last chance I was going to have to talk to you.
I wasn't ducking you, Sherman. I'm trying to explain. The only person I was ducking was Arthur. I just left. I didn't think. I just left. I went to Como. But I knew he could find me there. So I went to visit Isabel Dinodino. She has a place in the mountains, in a little town outside of Como. It's like a castle in a book. It was wonderful. No telephone calls. I didn't even see a newspaper.
All alone, except for Filippo Cirazzi. But that didn't matter either. As calmly as he could, he said, "It's nice that you could get away, Maria. But you knew I was worried. You knew about the piece in the newspaper because I showed it to you." He couldn't get the agitation out of his voice. The night that big maniac was here, I know you remember that.
Come on, Sherman, you're getting all worked up again.
Have you ever been arrested? He said.
No.
Well, I have. That was one of the things I did while you were away. He stopped, suddenly realizing he was doing something very foolish. To get her frightened about the prospects of being arrested was the last thing he needed to do right now. So he shrugged and smiled and said, "Well, it's an experience," as if to say, "but not as bad as you might think."
"But I've been threatened with it," she said.
"What do you mean?"
"A man from the Bronx District Attorney's office came around to see me today with two detectives."
This hit Sherman like a jolt.
"He did? A pompous little bastard. He thought he was being so tough. He kept throwing his head back and doing something weird with his neck like this, and looking at me through these little slits for eyes. What a creep."
"What did you tell him?" Very nervous now.
"Nothing. He was too busy telling me what he could do to me."
"What do you mean?" A riff of panic.
"He told me about this witness he has. He was so pompous and official about it. He wouldn't even say who it was, but it was obviously that other kid, the big one. I can't tell you what a jerk this man was."
"Was his name Kramer?"
"Yeah. That was it."
"He was the same one who was in court when I was arraigned.
He made it real simple, Sherman. He said if I would testify against you and corroborate the other witness, he'd give me immunity. If I didn't, then I'd be treated as an accomplice, and they'd charge me with these felonies. I can't even remember what they were.
But surely
he even gave me these Xeroxes of stories in the newspapers. He practically drew me a map. These were the correct stories, and these were the ones you concocted. I'm supposed to agree with the correct stories. If I say what actually happened, I go to prison."
"But surely you told him what actually happened."
"I didn't tell him anything. I wanted to talk to you first."
He was sitting on the edge of the chair. "But, Maria, certain things are so clear-cut about this thing, and they don't even know them yet.
They've only heard lies from this kid who was trying to rob us. For example, it didn't happen on a street, it happened on a ramp, right? And we stopped because the road was blocked before we even saw anybody, right? Isn't that right?
He realized his voice had risen. A warm, sad smile, the sort of smile you give people who are in pain, came over Maria's face, and she stood up and put her hands on her hips and said,
"Shaman, shaman, shaman, what are we gonna do with you?"
She slewed her right foot out in a certain way she had, and let it pivot for a moment on the heel of her black high-heeled shoe. She gave him a look with her big brown eyes and held out her hands toward him, palms up.
"Come here, shaman."
"Maria, this is important."
"I know it is. Just come here."
Christ, she wanted to embrace him again. Well, embrace her, you idiot. It's a sign she wants to be on your side. Embrace her within an inch of your life, yes. But how? I'm wired up. A cartridge of shame on my chest, a bomb of dishonor in the small of my back. What'll she want to do next, flop on the bed? What then? Well, good God, man. The look on her face says, "I'm yours. She's your ticket out. Don't blow this chance. Do something. Act." So he rose from the chair. He lurched toward the best of both worlds. He got into a crouch so that her chest wouldn't touch his, so the small of his back would be beyond the reach of her hands. He embraced her like an old man leaning over a fence to touch a flagpole. This brought his head down low. His chin was practically on her clavicle.
"Shaman," she said, "what's wrong? What's wrong with your back?"
"Nothing."
"You're all hunched over."
"I'm sorry." He turned sideways, with his arms still around her shoulders. He tried to embrace her sideways.
"Shaman," she stepped back for a moment, "you're all bent sideways. What's the matter? You don't want me to touch you?"
"No, no, I guess I'm just tense. You don't know what I've been through." He decided to improve on that. "You don't know how much I've missed you, how much I've needed you." She studied him, then gave him the warmest, wettest, most labial look imaginable.
"Well," she said, "here I am."
She stepped toward him. He was in for it now. No more crouching, you dolt, no more sidewinding. He'd have to take a chance. Maybe the microphone was down deep enough so that she wouldn't feel it, especially if he kissed her feverishly. Her arms would be around his neck. So long as she kept them there, she'd never get to the small of his back. They were just inches apart. He slipped his arms under hers in order to force hers up around his neck. He embraced her around her shoulder blades to keep them forced up high. Awkward, but it would have to do.
"Oh, Maria."
This kind of passionate moan wasn't typical of him, but it would have to do also. He kissed her. He closed his eyes in the interest of sincerity and concentrated on bracing his arms up high on her torso. He was conscious of flesh slightly caked with lipstick and warm saliva and the smell of her breath, which bore the recycled vegetable smell of gin. Wait a minute. What the hell was she doing? She was sliding her arms down outside of his arms, down toward his hips. He raised his elbows and tensed the muscles of his upper arms to try to force her arms away from his body without making an obvious point of it. Too late. She had her hands on his hips, trying to press his hips against hers. But her arms weren't long enough. Suppose her hands then edged up to the small of his back. He jutted his tail out. If her fingers lost contact with his hips, maybe she'd give up. Her fingers, where were they? For a moment he felt nothing. Then, something on his waist, on the side. Shit! Confuser. That was his only chance. Her lips remained pressed against his. She squirmed rhythmically and passionately amid the high vegetable funk. He squirmed back and jiggled his hips a bit to throw her off. Her fingers, he'd lost them again. Every nerve fiber was on red alert, seeking to detect their presence. All at once, her lips stopped squirming. Their lips were still together, but the motor had cut out. She disengaged her mouth and pulled her head back a few inches so that he saw three eyes swimming in front of his face. But her arms were still around him. He didn't like the way those three eyes swam.
"Shaman, what's this on your back?"
"My back?" He tried to move, but she stayed with him. Her arms were still around him.
"There's a lump, a piece of metal or something. This thing on your back?"
Now he could feel